Good morning. President Trump shifted his view of Russia and Ukraine yet again this week, saying Ukraine could win the war. So how are Ukrainians taking the news? We have voices from Kyiv in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Student demonstrations in Bangladesh last year caused the prime minister to flee. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And Amy Martinez will ask the country's interim leader why Gen Z revolutions are spreading across Southeast Asia. Also, Obamacare subsidies are at the heart of the government's shutdown fight. What happens if they go away? It's Thursday, September 25th. On this day in 1965, Satchel Paige came back to play Major League Baseball for one more game. At 59 years old, he gave up a hit over three innings. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says if there's a government shutdown next week, it won't just furlough federal workers, it will permanently lay them off. NPR's Tamara Keith has more.
President Trump says he wants congressional Democrats to agree to a short-term bill keeping government funding at current levels. If they don't, there's now a threat of consequences. In a memo to agency heads obtained by NPR, the White House Office of Management and Budget says that if there is a shutdown, they expect agencies to issue reduction in force notices to employees working on projects that are not consistent with the president's priorities. This would be a significant shift from past government shutdowns when employees were only temporarily furloughed. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called it an attempt at intimidation. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
The FBI is investigating yesterday's deadly shooting at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Dallas as an attack against ICE law enforcement. No ICE officers were harmed, but one ICE detainee was killed and two others were wounded. Federal officials say the apparent shooter took his own life. Speaking at a rally in North Carolina, Vice President J.D. Vance charged others with creating conditions for the attack.
Here's what happens when Democrats like Gavin Newsom did say that these people are part of an authoritarian government. When the left-wing media lies about what they're doing, when they lie about who they're arresting, when they lie about the actual job of law enforcement, what they're doing is encouraging crazy people to go and commit violence.
House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries denounced the violence, too.
The level of political violence and ideologically motivated violence across the spectrum is far too high in the United States of America right now. We need leadership that brings people together, not national leadership that tears people apart.
The shooter's motive has not been disclosed. The family of a passenger who was killed in January when a plane collided with an Army helicopter over Washington, D.C., is suing the government and the airlines involved. 67 people were killed in the crash. NPR's Joel Rose has more.
The lawsuit names American Airlines as well as PSA Airlines, the regional carrier that was operating the flight, as defendants, along with the federal government. The plaintiff is Rachel Crafton, the wife of Casey Crafton, who died in the mid-air collision. Her lawyers say they're trying to hold American Airlines, along with the Federal Aviation Administration and the U.S. Army, accountable for the deadliest U.S. plane crash in decades. In a statement, American Airlines said that it would fight any allegation the airline caused or contributed to the accident. The family members of other victims are expected to file lawsuits of their own. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been convicted on one charge in his case of French campaign finance fraud. Sarkozy's conviction is for taking campaign money from then-Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Officials in Denmark could turn to NATO for consultations after the latest mysterious drone swarm last night. Drones buzzed around an airport in northern Denmark last night, forcing it to close. The same thing happened to airports in Copenhagen and in Oslo, Norway this week. Officials say Russian involvement cannot be ruled out. Russia says any allegation like that is unfounded. New research published in the journal The Lancet suggests that cancer deaths could nearly double by the year 2050. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, More than two-thirds of those deaths are projected to occur in low- and middle-income countries.
To estimate how cancer cases and deaths could grow, the researchers analyzed two decades' worth of data from more than 200 countries and territories. They found cases and deaths have risen substantially, even with advancements in treatment. In 2023, about 18.5 million people died from cancer, up nearly 75%. The increase in cancer mortality wasn't equal across countries. While chances of surviving many cancers improved in wealthy countries, death rates got worse in many poorer ones, where it can be harder to access treatment. But there's some good news looking forward. Nearly half of these deaths came from cancers that have clear risk factors that can be avoided, like smoking or poor diet. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota history in 90 seconds.
So it's the year 1890 and you're scouring the job listings in the paper when you come upon this one.
Wanted at once. Good, steady, reliable man as houseman to tend fires, etc.
Not an easy opportunity to pass up. Craig Johnson is the manager of the James J. Hill House in St. Paul, where if you got the job, you would have been working.
When James J. Hill built his new dream house at 240 Summit Avenue in St. Paul, it was, of course, staffed by about 10 or 12 live-in domestic servants. And in such a large house, 36,000 square feet over five floors, it was sometimes hard to get the help you needed when you wanted. So there was, of course, an annunciator, a large servant call board, and when any of the servants heard one of these bells go, they would know to take a look at the board, see the room number, and go running to find out what James J. Hill wanted.
As for your boss, he was
often called the empire builder in his day because he was the man who was both the vision and the energy behind the creation of the Great Northern Railway. At the time of his death in 1916, he had amassed a personal fortune of $63 million with an estimated $200 million in related assets.
Sort of like working for Bill Gates, except with a bell.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Coming up, what do pediatricians say about the president's advice on hepatitis B? First, we have some global diplomacy.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia's war on Ukraine is fueling an arms race that is threatening humanity and that the war will spread if Russia is not forced into a durable peace deal.
Zelensky said that at the UN General Assembly on Wednesday. He spoke during a week when President Trump again shifted his stance on the war, asserting this time that Ukraine could win and that the United States would keep supplying weapons. But how do all those words sound when they're heard in the country that's under attack?
Joining us now to discuss all of this is NPR's correspondent Joanna Kakissis, who is in Kyiv. Joanna, so Ukrainians, how are they reacting to President Trump's seemingly sudden about-face on Ukraine?
Well, Ukrainians have been telling me that they are grateful Trump seems to be acknowledging Russia is the aggressor in this war and that he is talking about Ukraine's territorial integrity, because earlier this year, the Ukrainians heard Trump saying that their country does not have the cards to win and seem to be pushing Ukraine into giving up its territory in exchange for a peace deal with Russia. Now, that said, Trump has also not offered Ukraine things like concrete security guarantees or additional U.S. sanctions on Russia. I spoke with Alexander Kraev. He's the director of the North America program at the Ukrainian PRISM Foreign Policy Council here in Kyiv. And he said that it sounds like Trump is also saying something that he said before.
He's not speaking about America doing more or himself doing something additional. So he's just stating the fact that somebody should do something about it, but definitely not me.
So Kraev said that the Trump administration could be distancing itself from the peace process and shifting the burden onto the European Union.
But is that even possible, I mean, at this stage, for the U.S. to distance itself from a peace process?
Well, Zelensky has said repeatedly that the U.S. is key to securing a durable peace deal. He upped the ante at the U.N. by saying that the war is fueling a global arms race with, quote, weapons evolving faster than our ability to defend ourselves. I also spoke with Oleksandr Mereshko. He's a lawmaker from Zelensky's party and head of Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee. And he said Trump has already made big promises, like saying he will put maximum pressure on Russia to agree to an unconditional ceasefire.
He promised also severe consequences for Russia if Russia rejects this. So it's too late for Trump. It is his war. So he just needs to be consistent and to deliver on his promises if he wants to remain a credible politician.
And I also spoke with yet another member of parliament, Ivana Klimpush-Tsensada, and she said that it would be close to impossible for Ukraine to reclaim occupied land entirely through military means.
And without U.S. engagement, it will be very, very difficult, because I don't think that Russia is capable of changing its behavior if it doesn't feel the pressure, if it doesn't feel the economic pain, industrial pain, military pain of its own actions.
So what she's saying is Russia won't negotiate unless the U.S. forces it to.
Yeah, and there's that. So how has Russia responded to President Trump's apparent shift?
Well, the Kremlin has dismissed Trump's suggestion that Ukraine could win this war. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov also took issue with Trump calling Russia a paper tiger, that it looks strong but is actually weak. Peskov said, actually, Russia's a bear, and there's nothing paper about a bear. So it's a cryptic message, but a sign that Russia won't end its war on Ukraine anytime soon.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis is in Kyiv. Joanna, thanks.
You're welcome.
Okay, we heard some Ukrainian voices on President Trump's apparent shift on Ukraine. Also a Russian assertion that they're not a paper bear. But in any case, let's hear an American too, William Taylor, who's a longtime U.S. diplomat who has been ambassador to Ukraine and also served in the first Trump administration. Ambassador, welcome back.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
President Trump wanted to end this war on day one of his second administration. We just heard a Ukrainian analyst read his latest comments as saying, okay, I'm done here. Somebody else's problem. Is that how you hear it?
It's not, Steve. I think President Trump is committed. As you say, he started off committing to in the campaign. He said he's going to do it in 24 hours. Well, it turns out to be harder than that. Turns out that his buddy Putin was not ready to make any deals. But President Trump has stuck with it. He's made this, as near as I can tell, the top foreign policy priority of this administration. So I think he's committed. I think he's there.
Well, that's really interesting. There's a question that I've raised with a number of guests on this program, as listeners will know. I'm going to raise it again with you. There are at least two views of President Trump and the way that he would think through a situation like this. And one idea is that he doesn't learn, that he's been repeating the same slogans since the 1980s. But another view of the president is that he does learn, that he adapts, that he adjusts, that he makes tactical changes. Do you think he's learning here through this process?
Absolutely learning. He is, again, he thought he could make a deal with President Putin. He has learned, and I think he's really learned, that he can't. That Putin is not for turning. Putin is not for negotiating. Putin is not for ending this war. Putin is for continuing this war. And President Trump has figured that out. I think he's also figured out that President Putin has been stringing him along, tapping him along, I think the president said. And that is that's where President Trump is. So he's now ready to support the Ukrainians.
Is he in a stronger position politically then? Because the president has this faction of his party that really wants out of this conflict, but he has shown that that's not really possible right now.
It is not really possible right now, and it's not clear where the Republican Party is. What we do know is there are 86 sponsors and co-sponsors of a bill in the United States Senate, 86, that put harsh sanctions on Russia and nations that buy oil from Russia, a strong support for Ukraine. That's 86. When you ask the American people, same strong support. So I think he's got political cover to do exactly this.
But let's try to figure out this situation. The president also said Russia can lose the war. They're a paper tiger. Ukraine could end up actually taking some of their territory. But I come back to some fundamental realities here, realities of numbers and size. Both countries are suffering. Both countries are losing lots of lives every day, and Russia is still a lot bigger, a bigger economy, a bigger population. What is the way, if any, for Ukraine to overcome that?
The way is what Zelensky said yesterday, allies, allies and weapons. And he's got a lot of allies. He's got more allies than the Russians do. The Russians have, what, the North Koreans and the Iranians, with rhetorical support from the Chinese. So the Ukrainians have allies. They have NATO, they have the EU, they've got, South Korea, they've got allies. And what is necessary is weapons. They make their own. They make 50%, Ukrainians make 50% of the weapons that are being used on the battlefield now. They need the sophisticated, heavy-duty weapons that the West can provide.
It seems to me that the Trump administration then has reverted to something like President Biden's approach to the war. Ukraine fights the war. The United States, the West, supplies Ukraine as necessary, with one adjustment, that the U.S. doesn't want to keep sending free weapons to Ukraine. It wants to sell weapons to NATO nations that would then pass them on to Ukraine. How does that approach compare to Ukraine's needs? By which I mean, are they currently getting everything they need? And if not, what else do they need?
They're not getting everything they need. What they need is the long-range weapons that go deep into Russia at military targets, that can take out military depots, ammunition dumps. They go after the airfields. This is what they're doing with their smaller drones, which are great. They're doing a great job against the refineries. But what they need is a large number of deep strike large missiles.
Americans used to worry about triggering World War III or a nuclear response if Ukraine was allowed to attack Russia too harshly. Are we no longer worried about that?
Of course, we always have to be somewhat worried about that, but there is no indication that that's a serious concern, no indication that that's what the Russians would resort to. There would be no military benefit to them to doing that, and the political backlash would be terrible.
One final thing. Are you sure that this is the president's final position, that he won't shift again the day after tomorrow?
No one can be sure of that, Steve. Of course. What we have to do, though, is build on what we've got today. And what we've got today is strong support for Ukraine and really a harsh condemnation of the Russians.
William Taylor is a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and served in the first Trump administration. Ambassador, always a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Steve.
It's unusual for presidents to give out medical advice, but in a White House press briefing earlier this week, President Trump questioned the wisdom of vaccinating all newborns against hepatitis B.
There's no reason to give a baby that's almost just born hepatitis B. So I would say wait till the baby is 12 years old.
Pediatricians say that's not only wrong, but also dangerous. Here's NPR's Maria Godoy.
Hepatitis B is a virus that attacks the liver. The disease has no cure and can lead to liver cancer, cirrhosis, and death. And the risks of these outcomes is much higher for people who get infected as infants. Here's Dr. Andrew Pavia, a pediatric infectious disease specialist with the University of Utah.
About 25% of children who develop chronic hepatitis B will die of their infection.
Before the U.S. began universally vaccinating newborns in 1991, some 18,000 children each year became infected before the age of 10. About half were infected by their mothers at birth. The other half got it from somewhere else. President Trump said hepatitis B is sexually transmitted, so there's no reason to give the vaccine to a baby. But Pavia says the risks for kids are everywhere.
There have been cases of infections in daycare. There have been cases of infection on sports teams. There have been documented infections from shared toothbrushes and from shared razors.
The virus is found in blood, saliva, even tears, and it can live on surfaces for up to 7 days. A child with a wound who comes into contact with that surface even days later could become infected. Dr. Anita Patel is a pediatrician in Washington, D.C. She says many people don't know they have the virus, but they can still pass it on unwittingly.
If you have a cut, that blood could potentially get on the infant. And if that infant has any sort of break in their skin, as infants frequently do, they can then get hepatitis B.
She says that's why it's so important to give the shot at birth. Since that became routine in the U.S., case rates have plummeted by 99% among people age 19 and younger. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
submarines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled in Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Just over a year ago, massive student demonstrations in Bangladesh led Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to flee the country after 15 years of increasingly authoritarian rule. Military leaders assented to the protesters' demand that Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus be appointed interim leader. He's scheduled to speak at the UN General Assembly Friday, where he told me the message he wants to convey is one that also drives him as an individual.
We have to create a new world. A world of three zeros, zero net carbon emission, zero wealth concentration, zero unemployment.
It all represents a remarkable turn of events for Yunus, a prominent economist known for his decades of work on strategies to fight poverty. He'd been among the many critics targeted by Sheikh Hasina. At the time of the protest, Yunus had been fearing arrest on what he said were trumped-up charges. Then seemingly overnight, he became the country's leader, promising to serve only until elections are held. I met him last year as he was still coming to terms with stepping in as interim, and I met him again this week in New York. Muhammad Yunus, thank you so much for speaking with us once again.
Thank you. Thank you for coming back.
It's not easy inheriting the hopes and dreams of millions of people who aspired for change. It was a surprise when you were asked to take over this role as interim leader. What's been the hardest part for you, and is there anything that's really surprised you?
Not surprised me, but disappointments.
Like what? Give an example.
For example, law enforcement. These are the same people who were shooting at the young students. Suddenly, they are the one that put the law and order on the street. And people say, you are the one who are shooting at me. People who did it, they were demoralized because they are afraid that they will be beaten up. There is no identity that this guy is wrong, this guy is right. For them, these are police wearing the uniform. So
the lack of trust.
Lack of trust.
Sort of the normal sort of mechanisms of civil order have been really broken. And what do you feel like you're making any progress in restoring that kind of trust?
We have to come a long way, definitely. I think within this period, we restored the confidence in the police force. But again, you're in a broken system. It takes time for people to have complete trust.
Transparency International Bangladesh is a global anti-corruption good governance organization. It says that there is still a persistence of mob violence and there is still the persistence of extrajudicial killings. Do you agree with that? Is that true in your estimation as well?
First problem is Sheikh Hasina is not giving up. Mm-hmm. She's in India. She has set up her office, controlling her party members inside the country. Many leaders have fled, but the followers are still there. The diehard ones who benefited from this government. And they have enormous amount of money that took away from Bangladesh. They're controlling it, pushing it back again so that they can create trouble inside the country. The threat is the fact that the government of India is allowing Sheikh Hasina to do that out of the soil of India. And in the meantime, we have announced the election. So we want to have an environment where election can take place.
I understand that elections have been set for February of 2026. Is that correct?
That's right.
Do you think you're on track to keep that date?
Oh, it's very much. People are very happy that we are pursuing that objective. We have three objectives. One is the reform. And the second commitment is the trial of the leaders who are behind all the killings and so on, mismanagement of the country. And the last one is the election. All the political parties are on board, so we are preparing for the election to come.
Is it your belief that members of the party that Sheikh Hasina belonged to, the Awami League, will participate in elections?
No, they are not allowed to participate.
They are not allowed to participate.
Not allowed because their activities are banned.
If leaders of the party were to renounce violence and to take accountability for past violence, would they be allowed to participate?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we don't know in what terms they are saying that, and they are showing on the street. Today, they are occupying the street, and suddenly they come in a big force to disrupt the political activities in the country.
So let's talk about the economy, because I think, as many people may remember, that your core expertise is economics. You're the founder of the Grameen Bank, which pioneered the microloans to help people improve their standard of living and so forth. So how would you assess how the economy is doing? What's going well, and what are the pain points, as far as you understand?
We've come a long way. Mm-hmm. It was a devastated economy. So we have to start all over again to make sure that banks start functioning, businesses start functioning, we start paying back our obligations to the international companies and so on. So we are on track.
But is it my understanding that in 2024, about 20% of the country's total disbursed loans defaulted, which was actually 28% higher than the previous year? Is this correct?
Yeah, it was just a devastated economy.
Yeah.
So we took the country, if you can imagine, 15 years of earthquake. What do you see? Pieces. So you have to find the pieces to put together to start again. So this is the 1 year period that we have spent busy with doing that. So that would be a good occasion to see that happy ending for the interim government. So we hand over the responsibility of running the government to the elected people.
And you have no intention of standing for election?
No, not me. I came from another world. I'll go back to my world.
I wish I could describe the hand gesture you just made. It was like, no. It was big no. Duly noted.
Absolutely.
You know what I wanted to ask you about? You know, Nepal recently had its own Gen Z revolution. It lasted less than 48 hours. In the past couple of years, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal. I was just wondering, what do you make of these uprisings that seem to have rippled across South and Southeast Asia? What do you make of it?
I would say two things. One, young people today can communicate very well because of technology. They can implement their ideas as quickly as anybody could even dream. At the same time, while they are becoming powerful, there's a tremendous amount of corruption in the system. They're suffering from this corruption, and they don't see future. So they stand out against that. And this is what happened in Bangladesh.
What do you say to young people who say that I put my body on the line for change and I don't see it yet? How do you encourage them? What do you say?
Keep fighting. Don't give up. This is your country. You have to build your own country the way you want.
That is the interim leader of Bangladesh, Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Now, they mentioned a group called the Awami League allegedly causing trouble in India. We did reach out to that group, haven't heard back. We also heard from the government of India, which said last month it is, quote, not aware of any anti-Bangladesh activities by purported members of the Awami League in India. This is NPR News.
The U.S. is in the middle of an affordable housing crisis. Could a silver tsunami of aging Americans fix it when they sell their homes?
Older individuals are expected to either downsize or when they move on and pass the home on to their kids, potentially their kids would actually put them on the market for sale.
I'm Elsa Chang. That's on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in for All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's here on People Powered, KAXE. It's 529. I'm Heidi Holton with Malachi Coons this morning. We'll bring you a mix of National Public Radio news and local features. Today's kind of a cavalcade of journalists. We'll be checking in with our reporter, Larissa Donovan, at about 7:45, talking about some of the stories she's been working on, especially Black Duck and the possibility of a cannabis industry there. We'll also be talking with a MinnPost reporter about food insecurity in grocery stores and small towns. And Aaron Brown is going to be joining us later today. He'll be talking with us about one of his latest columns that is about U.S. steel and the Trump administration and how it affects the Iron Range right now. You can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, a boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You save time and money while defending the KEXE programs that you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. That's 855-277-2346. Or let us know. Give us a call. Weather around our region, we're expecting another beautiful day. Sunny skies, highs in the mid to upper 70s, overnight lows in the upper 40s, and tomorrow, Friday, sunny with highs 70 to 75, southwest winds from 5 to 10. All this week, we've been hearing from folks about places to go, your favorite tree maybe when it changes colors, what you look at or where you like to go each fall to check it out. You can text us your stories, your ideas to 218-326-1234. I went to the North Shore last week. Was not quite there yet on colors. I'm seeing much more around here right now, but we hope to hear from you this morning. Up next, it's our Daily Dose of Nature with John Latimer.
On today's date, September 25th, 1991, my wife Denise reports hearing the call of a saw-whet owl. You don't often hear saw-whet owls calling in the fall. They are primarily late March, early April singers in the spring as they return from their migration. What my wife was hearing was a migrating saw-whet owl. Few of us are ever aware of their migration because they do it at night and they do it very carefully and cautiously, and without a lot of fanfare. There are no great flocks of saw-whet owls flying south. Rather, a steady wave of them moving through our area. And there are a lot of saw-whet owls, way more than you might suspect. And it is very unusual for you to find them in the fall as they're migrating. But there was a fellow up in the Big Fork area for several years who caught, trapped, and banded the saw-whet owls, and his numbers indicate a huge migration every fall. He had one night 43 birds that he trapped and banded in that evening. So whether you realize it or not, this is the time of year when the saw-whet owls are sneaking past your home.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance. From filing returns to tracking assessments, learn more at avalara.com/property tax. And from The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Government shutdown is looking more and more likely, and this time it could be far more severe than in the past.
A memo from the White House instructs federal agencies to prepare mass firing plans if funding lapses at the end of the month. This plan goes beyond the usual temporary furloughs during a shutdown. It would permanently cut jobs in programs that are established by law but the president doesn't like. As so often happens, Republicans and Democrats do not agree on a funding measure for the fiscal year that is about to start. Republicans want a short-term extension, while Democrats have insisted that extension should include some protections for people who have health insurance premiums to pay.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin covers all things health insurance. All right, so let's start with deadlines here. The shutdown could start next week, but there are other key dates at play.
Yeah, so in just over a month, on November 1st, open enrollment begins on the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. You might know them as Obamacare, healthcare.gov. That's all the same thing. And this is where people shop for insurance if they don't get it through their job. So, you know, a lot of freelancers, small business employees. At the end of the year, something called the enhanced premium tax credits expire. Those have kept premiums affordable for people who get their insurance this way. And if Congress doesn't act to extend those tax credits in the next week or two, people are going to get sticker shock when open enrollment starts and they see that monthly amount they pay for health insurance is going to go way up next year.
Where did these tax credits come from?
So when the ACA was passed way back in 2010, Congress created kind of a sliding scale to help give people a break on their premiums. But the way it was originally set up didn't work very well. Premiums were still really high for a lot of people, so enrollment was sluggish. And in 2021, Congress stepped in. They sweetened the pot with a lot more federal funding, which made premiums more affordable for people at all income levels. Sabrina Corlett of the Georgetown Center on Health Insurance Reform told me that worked. Enrollment more than doubled. It's now 24 million people, and the uninsured rate for the entire country sank to the lowest it's ever been.
Incredibly successful effort to get more people into coverage and reduce the uninsured rate.
All right, so what happens, though, if the enhanced credits expire?
In short, people's costs will go up and enrollment will drop. Ultimately, millions of people could become uninsured. Yesterday, I talked with Emily Pizzacreta. She's a senior producer with the healthcare podcast An Arm and a Leg, which partners with KFF Health News and NPR member station KUOW. They just did an episode about her quest to find ACA insurance, something she really needs since she has type 1 diabetes. She found a plan that works for her for $500 per month, but it could get much more expensive next year if those enhanced credits expire.
$500 a month is not little, and to imagine it going up to almost $900 a month seems really scary.
I talked to somebody who lives in West Virginia who's putting money aside that would go to retirement because of these changes. And another person in Florida told me he's considering finding a new job with benefits if his premium becomes unaffordable.
So what are the politics on all this? Where does that stand right now?
There are Republican lawmakers who would like to extend these tax credits, others who really don't want to. But either way, it's really hard to see this getting resolved before a shutdown next week, since there are currently no active talks between the two parties.
That's NPR health policy correspondent Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
This week, the Trump administration went beyond the evidence, according to scientists and doctors, not just in linking Tylenol to autism, but also insisting that another drug might treat it. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on how families are responding.
Katie Donovan's daughter, Scarlett, was 17 months old when she was diagnosed with autism.
We were told she would never speak, a direct quote from the doctor. We'd be lucky if she sat and banged her head against a wall. That was what we were told.
Now, 9 years later,
she plays flag football. She did cheer for 4 years. She talks nonstop.
Donovan says it wasn't any drug, but years of therapies for speech, movement, behavior, and even eating that helped. Donovan now understands autism is complex with mostly genetic origins. But for years, she agonized whether something she did or didn't do might have caused the condition.
You go through this self-blame and you beat yourself up and you ask yourself a million questions. And I've been in therapy for many years and worked on this a lot to come to the conclusion that it isn't something I did. This is just who my daughter is. And she's perfect the way she is. And this is not my fault.
So she was dismayed hearing President Trump and his deputies talk about autism. In particular, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said this when announcing the Food and Drug Administration greenlit broader use of leucovorin.
Our research has revealed that folate deficiency in a child's brain can lead to autism, We have also identified an exciting therapy that may benefit large numbers of children who suffer from autism.
Scientists question both statements. Leucovorin is a chemotherapy drug that treats folate or vitamin B deficiencies. Studies of its use on those with autism are very limited. Anyway, Donovan says, suggesting autism has simple causes or solutions is wrong. She worries it will confuse and frighten other families.
On one hand, telling me that a medication caused it, and then on the other hand, telling me that a medication could fix it, I think I'd be scared.
Alicia Halliday shares those concerns. Halliday is a doctor, parent of a daughter with autism, and chief scientific officer of the Autism Science Foundation. She says the administration is bypassing normal research and safety checks with leucovorin, pinning its faith on a small study showing the drug may alleviate some symptoms for a subset of autistic patients with cerebral folate deficiency.
The study was very small. It didn't have any safety data. They are jumping the gun a little bit, but I don't think most people really understand the rigor that the FDA normally would apply.
She is also critical of statements by Mehmet Oz, head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
State Medicaid programs in partnership with CMS will cover prescription leucovorin around the country. It's yours, but you have to go to a doctor to get a prescription.
Halliday says, in fact, the White House is allowing leucovorin only for that subset of autistic patients with a vitamin B deficiency.
It was disingenuous to tell people at the press conference that it was going to be made available to everybody. I think families should know that, in fact, it's not going to be approved or made available to the wide autism community. It's only going to be made available to those with a documented cerebral folate deficiency.
Nevertheless, she says many families are excited.
People have been asking their doctors for this, and their doctors have been telling them there's not enough safety data, there's not enough effectiveness data.
Halliday says the administration is essentially testing leucovorin in the real world. The administration says it will collect data to see what happens, quote, over the next few months. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from National Public Radio here on People Powered KAXE. It's 542. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. We appreciate it. We've got more news coming up next for you from National Public Radio. Find out what's going on locally. We've got a news team that is covering the issues in our region. We cover a vast area, so we also rely on you to give us tips on what is happening in your community. You can check it out right now at kaxe.org. Check out some of our stories, including a story remembering Simone Senegals, a woman from Bemidji who passed away last weekend and has had a profound impact on social justice issues in the city of Bemidji, but also in northwestern Minnesota and the state in general, being a part of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We've got more there on Simone and remembrances that you could attend. We're also learning about, on our website, Kitchigami Regional Library System offering art kits. Check it all out at kaxe.org. Weather today going to be beautiful, sunny, highs in the mid to upper 70s, overnight lows in the upper 40s. Tune in at 9 o'clock this morning. It is Headwaters with DJ Dang. Volunteer programming coming up at 1 o'clock. Jeff Edmonds will be back for On the River and Ben Franklinstein tonight at 7 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you're having a good morning.
You should give as you are able because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time. This is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at kaxe.org. Thank you for your support.
Nastation. And from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And Amy Martinez. Flooded businesses, neighborhoods burned to ash. Americans are feeling the effects of disasters fueled by climate change, and some state and local governments have responded by filing lawsuits to make fossil fuel companies pay for the damages that communities are facing. Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is trying to help the industry fight back. Here's NPR's Michael Copley.
At a hearing on Capitol Hill this summer, Cruz claimed repeatedly that China is funding climate lawsuits in an effort to cripple U.S. oil and gas companies.
We're witnessing right now a systematic campaign against American energy. There is a coordinated assault by the radical left, backed and paid for by the Chinese Communist Party.
The community lawsuits accuse the companies of misleading the public about the dangers of burning fossil fuels, the primary cause of climate change. Cruz said that if the cases are successful, U.S. energy production would fall and prices would rise, threatening what he said is the foundation of America's economy and national security.
And the biggest winner in all of this? China, who's paying the bills.
But Cruz's office hasn't offered evidence to support the senator's claim. Cruz said in a statement that China uses intermediaries and nonprofits to shape U.S. energy policy, including by funding litigation. But a spokesperson for Cruz sent NPR a response from ChatGPT that said a direct link between Chinese funding and U.S. climate lawsuits hasn't been shown publicly yet. If China were paying for court cases in the U.S., it would be a big deal, says Ilaria Mazzocco. She tracks Chinese business and economic issues at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So she says,
we should be very careful to actually know what's real and what's not.
The alleged funding scheme that Cruz described at the Senate hearing in June revolves around a nonprofit called Energy Foundation China. The group is headquartered in San Francisco with an office in Beijing. It's given money to U.S. nonprofits that work on climate change.
And this money isn't going to tree planting campaigns or to science fairs. It's flowing directly to aggressive litigation outfits like the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Rocky Mountain Institute, and the World Resources Institute.
Spokespeople for the Rocky Mountain Institute and World Resources Institute said their groups aren't involved in litigation and that the money they've received from Energy Foundation China has been used to cut climate pollution in China. The Natural Resources Defense Council is involved in environmental lawsuits in the U.S., but the group's chief litigation officer also says the money it's gotten from Energy Foundation China has only gone to climate programs in China. An executive at Energy Foundation China said the group's work is focused on China, and that it doesn't fund litigation in any country.
This hearing, it was largely just fabricated out of thin air.
That's Richard Wiles, president of the Center for Climate Integrity, which supports the climate lawsuits by filing legal briefs and providing documents to plaintiffs in the cases. Wiles says Cruz's China allegation was designed to give lawmakers political cover to create legal protection for the fossil fuel industry. Days before Cruz's Senate hearing on alleged Chinese funding, a group of Republican state attorneys general asked the Justice Department to recommend federal legislation to shield energy companies from climate lawsuits.
All these communities are asking is that the oil industry pay their fair share of the damages that they knowingly cause.
A lawyer for the American Petroleum Institute, a trade group for oil and gas companies, said in a statement to NPR that the climate lawsuits are baseless and that climate policy should be dealt with in Congress, not the courts. The oil and gas group wouldn't comment on the record about Cruz's allegation that China has been funding the lawsuits. Michael Copley, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town, and it magically became a, there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KAXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
Trump administration official warns of permanent layoffs if the federal government shuts down next week.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Avalara, providing cloud-based solutions for businesses to manage property tax compliance. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. If there's a partial government shutdown next week, the Trump administration is planning to permanently fire thousands of federal workers. Democrats and Republicans are fighting over funding. The government's next accounting year, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Office of Management and Budget sent out a memo with stark instructions for heads of federal agencies. They should consider layoff notices for all employees in programs that haven't been funded yet for the government's 2026 fiscal year, which starts October 1st. This would also apply to workers in programs that didn't get any additional money in President Trump's big tax and spending bill passed earlier this year. Employees in programs, quote, not consistent with the president's priorities would also have to go. Workers at the Pentagon and ICE would be spared, as would employees doing things that receive mandatory funding, like sending out Social Security checks. In a statement last night, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the OMB memo is an attempt at intimidation. The House passed a stopgap bill last week that would fund the government through November 21st, but it failed in the Senate. Democrats want any stopgap funding bill to include things like money for expiring subsidies for people buying health insurance on Obamacare exchanges. Republicans are insisting on what they call a clean bill. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Argentina's President Javier Milei has thanked the U.S. for its support after the Trump administration moved to financially backstop Milei, a leader seen as a political ally. The U.S. is in negotiations to lend $20 billion to Argentina's central bank and is ready to buy back U.S. debt. The BBC's Ione Wells reports.
President Javier Milei's party recently suffered election losses in Buenos Aires province, sparking concern he could face more political trouble ahead of the country's midterm elections in October. The losses raised doubts about the future of his radical cost-cutting program. The currency lost value as investors moved money out of the country. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Donald Trump have said they are prepared to do what is needed to support Argentina's currency. This has caused some pushback in the U.S., with some Democrats saying it is troubling the president would use emergency funds to inflate the value of a foreign government's currency.
The key stock index in Buenos Aires closed up 1.5% yesterday. Here, this morning, S&P and NASDAQ futures are down between 1 and 2/10 of 1%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, dedicated to helping businesses save time on office tasks and empower leaders with business buying solutions that support teams to focus on growing the business. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. and by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
For hundreds of years, Hispanic communities across the Southwest have relied on a network of hand-dug ditches to water their crops and feed their families. But now these traditions are under pressure from a changing climate and dwindling water. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radle spent time with farmers working to keep alive these historic waterways and the culture they carry.
Albuquerque's South Valley is surrounded by brown desert and towering red mesas. But inside this valley, the land is sprouting lush trees and green fields. Here, the Rio Grande River spills into irrigation ditches. They're called acequias and wind through the landscape of this small Hispanic community, carrying rain and snowmelt straight to crops. Farmer Santiago Maestas gestures to the acequia he gets water from.
It's totally a gravity-fed system. You don't use machinery as such.
No pumps, pipes, or sprinklers. Just flowing water that feeds farmland the old-fashioned way, by flooding it. For decades, Maestas has been doing that to grow apples, chili, and corn.
Our whole community basically is built around the irrigation canals, or ditches, acequias as we call them.
But he's worried that's at risk of fading into the past. Spanish colonists began digging these ditches in the 1600s. Now New Mexico has hundreds of acequias that function through community governance. Neighboring Colorado has a few dozen. Farmers pay dues, elect a manager to oversee each acequia, and share in their cleaning and upkeep. An hour north of Albuquerque, in La Cienega Valley, farmer J.J. Gonzalez is doing just that, scooping leaves, sticks, and sediment out of the acequia he manages.
There's always trash falling into the ditch. So this is the stopping point for the debris.
Gonzalez is at a head gate, which looks like a metal door set into the ditch that controls how much water is released. He says their water supply this year has been stable so far, but
usually we get the rain in the July and August, and it didn't materialize this year.
That's been the case most summers in the Southwest. Arizona and New Mexico are currently experiencing the worst drought in 1,200 years. And for an ancient ditch system that relies on gravity and flood irrigation, drought threatens the future of acequias. And these earthen canals are worth preserving for a number of reasons. Santiago Maestas points to research from New Mexico State University that shows they can hold water for long periods, and their seepage recharges groundwater that eventually returns to the river.
The valley's green because of the acequias. Without the acequias, the valley would be just as dry as the mesas that surround us.
Maestas says the farmers in this community plan to keep it that way as long as they can. In South Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm Caleb Radle for Marketplace.
In what appears to be prep for a shareholder lawsuit, the publication Semaphore says some holders of Disney stock have requested board notes, documents, and emails from ABC's parent company about the decision to suspend Jimmy Kimmel from his late-night show. Disney stock lost 2%, or about $4 billion in value, amid the backlash to Kimmel's firing after pressure from the chair of the Federal Communications Commission and President Trump. Kimmel's comments about the murder of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk prompted two large ABC affiliate groups to pull the Kimmel show before Disney ABC acted. Kimmel is back on, and Disney faces new promises of retaliation from President Trump. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, we'll have headlines from National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Programming this morning is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship September 2nd through noon on October 7th. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their leadership plan. Visit bushfoundation.org. Some of the things going on in our region, it is September 25th today, and Cross Lake Days start today. They'll be going on through the 27th. There's an arts and crafts fair, live music, cornhole tournament, and more. Find a full schedule at crosslake.com. Greater Lakes Area Performing Arts and Pequot Lakes Community Theater are presenting Annie. That begins today. goes through September 28th. It's at Pequot Lakes High School Theater. Thursday and Saturday shows at 7 and a Sunday matinee at 2 o'clock.